You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. Hello and welcome. In the novel 1984 by George Orwell, a term called thought crime was introduced to his readers. Thought crime is an illegal type of thought. The government in Orwell's masterpiece wants to control not just actions and speech, but the very thoughts of its citizens. Whew. The thought, no pun intended, of this is beyond frightening. We're lucky to live in a world that allows free and unfettered thought, no? No, it doesn't. My guest today may be the world's first internet website hostage, but we'll let you decide that. Ernst Zundel joins us from Germany. Ernst, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Ernst, you've read the novel 1984, haven't you?
We had it as a textbook at Sir George Williams University in the late 60s, where I was studying political science. But little did I know that George Orwell was the first, the absolutely first famous author to question the veracity of these claims that were made against Germany. He already in the summer of 1945, Orwell was the first to question whether these claims that American and Allied propaganda was broadcasting were in effect true. And we found that out and produced it as evidence in one of my trials.
Wow.
What a sensation that he was really the first revisionist.
You use the term revisionist. Can you explain, for the benefit of our listeners, what is a revisionist?
A revisionist is basically a scholar or a thinker or just an ordinary person that wants to revise after study and after research, revise what is commonly believed about an issue. For instance, okay. Columbus was a revisionist because he said that the earth was round and not flat. And he researched it and even went on a trip and proved that the earth was not flat. And so this is what revisionists do, regardless whether they are medical revisionists, they are nutritional revisionists. For instance, at one time, we didn't know the difference between oils, that there was kind of superheated oils or cold-pressed oils and so on. All this is basically the work of revisionists that re-examine any issue and come up with better ideas, newer ideas, more correct ideas.
Sounds like revisionism might be the engine of innovation.
Well, it is certainly a corrective. And, you know, this is the most natural thing in the world, actually. I mean, you and I, both of us, became our own revisionists when we rejected the idea of Santa Claus or Easter Bunny.
Right.
When we were kids, we were told on our mother's knee there was such a thing, or that the stork delivered children, you know. And so we revised it as we became mature, and we dumped erroneous beliefs and replaced them with facts. It's nothing criminal. It's the most natural human reaction and should be. Most people should revise some of their ideas that they erroneously hold, and many of them do.
Right, but the authorities have a problem with historical revisionism, don't they?
At the moment, yeah.
And you were born in the 30s, isn't that right?
Yeah, I was born shortly before the outbreak of World War II in Germany. There were more children born in German history in the year 1939 than at other time in German history. Germans had a baby boom beginning with about 1935, once things had stabilized and the system in place was promising work and there was full employment and there was peace at the time in the world, and the Germans began to produce children.
Right. They felt comfortable, I guess.
My mother told me I would have never been born because my father was unemployed for 3.5 years. And there was no brother or sister born before that because there was no work. Things were insecure. And so I was born thanks to the policies that were adopted by that government at that time.
You just had a normal childhood?
I was born in April, and the war broke out, of course, in September.
Right.
And so my father had been kind of an apolitical social democrat, and he opted for the medic wing of the army, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was an ambulance driver and finally worked as a soldier on these German ambulance trains that would pick up soldiers from the battlefields of Europe. And it was his stories that he told me about the horrible wounds inflicted in war on people that made me a pacifist. So when I was supposed to be drafted into the new German army post-World War II, I opted to come to Canada because in Canada nobody was drafted. I would have preferred to go to the United States because I always had a love for the United States because of their constitutional setup.
Right.
But I opted for Canada because I did not have to go to the army, because in the United States at the time there was the Korean War and then there was the Vietnam War. I was actually an enemy of war.
So you came to Canada when you were still a teenager.
I was 18 and a half, going on 19, yeah. And never regretted it, by the way. In spite of all the troubles that later on developed in my life, I found Canada a wonderful place. And at that time, the United States and Canada were so similar in makeup and in cultural feeling. I mean, there was as much freedom of speech in Canada at that time as there was in the United States, and we didn't have a First Amendment or an American-style constitution. But the two countries, the North American continent, was something very, very special.
And this was in the early 60s, late 50s.
Yeah, we are talking about late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm. And you're an artist by trade, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a graphic artist. I actually wanted to be a painter, you know, but we didn't have enough money to go to art school. And so luckily I went to this graphic arts company and never regretted it. It was a wonderful trade.
You got into other activities.
I sold in my career well over 2,000 of my own paintings.
Wow.
Watercolors, acrylics, and oil paintings. And naturally that was one aspect of my life. But after that, I began to study political science, architecture, traveled widely, made good money, traveled the world, and then began to publish first little articles, became an editor of a German language newspaper, assistant editor to a whole chain of German papers at the time, and published my own column in the university newspaper called Politics Past, Present, and Future, and was part of the university television station.
And what years were these?
We're talking 1966, 1968, 69.
Turbulent times, at least in the United
States. Oh, the free speech movement was something, you know, on the campuses in the United States and in Canada. I went through all that. It was a heady time, and I was opposed to the Vietnam War right from the beginning, because I saw through it. My argument was quite simply this: why go 17,000 kilometers away, Vietnam, to fight communism and allow Castro to operate 5 minutes away from the downtown Miami airbase, you know?
Right.
It didn't take a rocket scientist or a genius to figure out that there was something wrong with the policy. There was something going on that I didn't understand, you know?
So you were in many ways a child of the 60s.
Yeah, I was. It was a wonderful time to be alive, actually, especially in North America. Because then America was still the post-war industrialization. All the factories were brand new. The highways were being built basically on the German Autobahn system that Eisenhower was introducing, the interstate highway system based on the Autobahns, you know?
Right.
So there was public construction and infrastructure improvement. Dams were being built. Bridges were spanning canyons. America and Canada were pulsating, vibrating societies, and still lots of children. You can look at all these photos in the textbooks of those years. There have been, you know, in Jasper or in Yellowstone National Park, when there was a bear by the side of the road, piling out of the cars were all these American kids.
Right.
Today you see nothing like it.
They're all inside playing with their video games.
Those that were lucky to be born.
Right.
So few passed the hurdles with all kinds of preventions and abortion clinics and so on, you know.
So you got into historical revisionism at that time?
I was confronted by anti-German bigotry, which was like a hangover from the Second World War. There were all these shows, maybe you are too young for that, but Hogan's Heroes was one of them, you know?
Oh, yeah, that was one of my
favorites. And Rat Patrol was another one.
Sure,
you know? Or The Dirty Dozen, you know?
Right.
And these films were painting the Germans in a very negative light. And I was a German. I actually believed in all the stories that I learned after the Second World War in our Allied occupied schools. I hated the Hitler regime because that's what we were taught in school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was confronted, once I came to Canada, with a different kind of history, because Canada and America did not have its libraries cleaned out. You see, in Europe, every regime cleaned always the libraries out. For instance, in the Soviet occupation zones and in the Soviet satellites, they dumped all the old histories, you know, and they rewrote a new version of history. And in the West, they basically did the same. We were not only occupied in the East by the Soviet Union, but the Belgians, the Dutch, the French, the Canadians, the Americans, the British, they all occupied part of Germany. They had what they call occupation sectors. I was in the French sector, for instance, you know.
Is that where you're at right now?
That's where I'm right now, yeah.
Okay, in the Black Forest.
In the Black Forest, yeah.
You got into the historical revisionism for a variety of reasons. How did that progress then?
It started innocently enough. I just did what Canadians and Americans take as their birthright. And of course, I acculturated very quickly. I took to the Canadian and the American system like a duck takes the water, you know. So when I saw something that was said in books or shown in movies or on television programs that I knew was not right or was twisted, I would set pen to paper and I would write letters to the editor. That's how it started. Quite normal. I was a parent, I had two children, and I wanted my kids to be properly informed. I did not want my kids to be propagandized. I wanted my kids to be educated.
Right.
And so I did what responsible parents do, make sure that a kid was not ideologically warped. And of course, I went to night school, to evening university, to, you know, advance my own knowledge and so on. And I liked the North American university environment because, as I said earlier, it was the time of the free speech movement.
Right.
And there was a kind of a vitality in the American and Canadian political discourse that was not extant in Europe. You know, Europe had clamped down because of all the various wars and dictatorships and so on. America and Canada were like an elixir of modernity, you know. It was a wonderful place to be alive and to be a young man at that time.
As you continued to study and to teach your children the facts the way you saw them, you came against some forces that didn't appreciate.
It started actually at university, and I must say I had very good professors. It was in Montreal where I went to university. These people say that Sindel might, you know, we don't like what he's saying, but he cannot argue with his facts.
Right.
And I learned very early at university that you better did your research and did your footnoting and you documented what you found that you could argue. So the university was really the basis for my learning about research. That was a very helpful thing for me.
Right.
And I never looked back. Who ever thought in the United States that somebody would be ending up in a slammer for ideas or things?
You know? For thought crimes.
I mean, that's why we had George Orwell's book, 1984, as a textbook. This was like exotic at the time, the concept, you know.
Right.
Everybody was outraged. My God, could never happen with us. Look at, we have all this freedom, you know. Little did we know that a generation later we would have George Orwell alive.
So what happened after the university?
I began to travel widely. I went basically all around the globe, from India to Africa to China and Asia. I crisscrossed the United States, crisscrossed Canada. I had studied architecture and, of course, for part of political science, the old regimes in Greece and Rome. So I went from the textbook learning of the University of Sir George Williams in Montreal to my own sketching, filming, photographing, hands-on research in those faraway places. It expanded my horizon tremendously.
You had children at the time?
I had children, yeah, but my wife was a very tolerant lady, and she encouraged me because she knew that this was my life. I was constantly in search of knowledge and answers.
Right. How long did you travel around for?
I traveled basically all my life. After that, I had a very good trade in the graphic arts, had my own studio, had people working with me, and so the studio would run while I would go off. The longest trip I took around the world was 7.5 months.
So money was really not much of a problem for you?
Not for me at that time, no.
You got back from most of your travels, and then what happened?
Restarted my business, rekindled my business, and then I got quite ill. Because of the trips, I have no idea, but it was a kind of a life and death situation. I was confronted that I would die within 6 months. And during those 6 months, I naturally took stock about my life and decided, well, boy, I wasn't born into the world just to gratify my own thirst for knowledge or to make money in my business.
Right.
There must be a deeper purpose. And that's when I began to realize that whatever I had accumulated in knowledge, I better share it with the rest of the world. And I began to publish booklets and so on. And that's when my interview series started with eyewitnesses to the Second World War, and mainly German and Jewish eyewitnesses.
What years were these?
End of the 60s and then the 70s, massively the 70s. And because I was making good money, I could either bring these authors that I was researching and writing about, people that had written World War II documentaries, their own experiences, biographical things and so on. Either I flew to them in their countries or I brought them to Toronto and interviewed them then. at my place, and out of that came booklets, and one in particular that turned out to be like a karmic booklet was called Did 6 Million Really Die? ? That's the booklet that you could say put Ernst on the map.
You were simply publishing that, is that right?
Yeah, I never wrote that book. I only wrote a foreword and an afterword. Okay. In other words, out of this 32-page booklet, almost 30,000-word essay by a British university student, I had thought he was a professor because it said in the introduction that he worked at the university in England. Well, it turned out he was a student at the university. He was paid some money to write that booklet. It had the ring of truth, and I kept researching some of the claims made, and I found no major errors. There were a couple of typos, and dates were mixed up, and so on. The length of books was misstated, but even the telephone book has errors in it sometimes, you know? And so I never thought much of it. I published a booklet, distributed it widely, and then one day, whammo, I heard on the evening television news that I was going to be charged for publishing false news. And I had never even heard of that paragraph in the Canadian Criminal Code because it came from the year 1275.
British law.
It was an old British law that the King of England had passed against singing troubadours, you know, people that would go to taverns, and the king didn't like that. They said that he was overcharging taxes and blah, blah, and so they passed this law, and it was on the British law books, and when the British themselves took it out of their criminal code in the 1880s, but Canada being a backwater province, and India, those two, they kept it in their British-based criminal code. Thanks to my court case, the law was declared unconstitutional. After 9 years of litigation, the law was considered by the Canadian Supreme Court in a majority decision unconstitutional because of its ancient content. And I had always said, when they charged me in the beginning, I said, you cannot be serious. A law promulgated by a king in 1275, and now you're charging me in the year 1981. That is ridiculous, you know? And I gave press conferences to that effect and gave speeches and lectures. My attorney made these motions in court saying the same thing. On the face of it, it's unconstitutional, because by then Canada had adopted what they call the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which was really based on the United States Bill of Rights.
So when did they come after you then for publishing the booklet? What year was that?
The German system came after me earlier, but in Canada, they only came after me in December of 1983.
Right, okay.
Well, in the meantime, I was politically active.
Right.
I was a member of the Liberal Party in Canada, and that was the ruling party. And I became a candidate for prime minister in the late 60s and ran my campaign along liberal, conservative, national, and socialist ideas. I made it to the final contenders, and there were seven candidates, and I was one of them. And so I got the same airtime, addressed the nation, spoke in the sport stadium in Ottawa to 30,000 people, live audience.
How did you do?
I withdrew my candidacy because my point was made that I pleaded for fairer treatment for the European immigrants, and especially for the German ethnic group.
Was there a large German ethnic group in Canada at the time?
We were the third largest ethnic group, yeah, after the French Canadians.
From around 1976 till that time when they came after you for publishing that book, you did a lot of interviews on TV and radio.
I had published what I call my UFO series of books.
Okay.
These are books about flying saucers and German secret weapons and German aircraft design and so on. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I hit some kind of a real gold mine, you know?
Right.
It was a really highly popular issue in the 70s, and I got so many interviews, and the talk shows would call me. So that up to the 80s, I made about 140, 160 talk shows a year.
Wow.
On different talk radio stations in Canada and the United States.
So you kind of, in many ways, I guess, stumbled onto this UFO.
It was of interest to me because I had met a German aircraft engineer who had been with the Reichsluftfahrtministerium, meaning the German Air Ministry. Mm-hmm. And his job was to look at secret weapons and vehicles that the Germans were designing. And one of them was a circular flying craft. He wrote a very famous book about it that I think it's now in the 12th edition that says, it was even published in English, and it says the German secret weapons and their further development after World War II. Okay. And he had a section in there on German flying saucer designs. And they were reaching enormous speeds. And boy, it was seemingly really fascinating to the public, you know. It first captured my imagination. I said to myself, well, the world needs to know that. Nobody knows about this. So I published these relatively smaller pocket books, 160 pages, 200 pages.
Did you have a big base of subscribers?
I produced altogether 5 titles. Then ended up by doing the tragic booklet in a way that derailed my life, you know, about the 6 million thing.
Right. Did 6 million really die? It wasn't even your book.
No, it was that British man's book. And I also, like it with the flying saucer story, you know, I was a total believer in freedom of speech, freedom of research, freedom of thought. And to me, that was like unlimited universe. And I actually put a question mark behind all my books. You know, I said, look, these are ideas. I'm putting it out for public consumption, and you make up your own mind. I always put question marks on it because I'm only Ernst. I'm not God. I'm not the fount of all wisdom, you know. It was fun.
You're not telling anybody how to think. You just want them to learn.
Yeah, I want them to think, but I'm not telling them what to think or how to think, you know.
Right. So you had quite a few people who bought your publications.
Right.
And tell our listeners what happened in 1981 with that police raid.
Because of that UFO series of books, I got a certain amount of public recognition, high-profile interviews. And so, based on my buyer's list, I was like a niche publisher. And then I thought to myself, well, this is questioning some of the verities, supposedly, of World War II. That's part of the niche publishing. I'll open up a subject, you know, throw it out for debate. That's
right.
In my naivety. I thought, you know, everything was open for debate. It was the time when we could even question God. You remember all these books at the time, you know?
So what happened in 81?
Well, suddenly I heard from the Canadian media that people who had bought books from me in Germany had been raided. There were massive police raids in Germany from the north by the Danish border all the way down to the Swiss and Austrian borders. Over 2,000 of my book buyers were raided, and truckloads full of my books and tapes, audio tapes, were taken away, and they were preparing a case against me.
Ernst, how big was this raid?
According to Der Spiegel magazine, that did an article on that,
right.
10,000 policemen were involved and police women, and about 300 prosecutors and 50 judges.
And they did this in one night?
In one night. Was the largest police raid, according to Der Spiegel, in German history, bar none. And then they seized my bank account. Well, that was an insult, you know. They seized my bank account. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, all my whole supporters base was up in arms because naturally, who would like to knock at the door at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know? It did cause a lot of controversy, caused again a lot of media publicity. But then after 2 years of litigation in Stuttgart in the court, I won my case.
How did you win it?
It was found that my books were not publishing hate. At that time, this was still possible, that you could actually have a debate about historical subjects. And so the German judges found, no, Zündel was not publishing hate, and ordered the German state to return to my friends all the seized books and return my money to me that was accumulated in the bank account.
And did you have to go to Stuttgart?
I went to Germany after I won the case. Uh-huh. My attorney at the time was Jürgen Rieger, who just tragically died at age 63.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, who was my lawyer from that moment on till he died.
So this was in 1981, and 2 years later, 1983.
The German government decided they're not going to give me my passport because of all this controversy, you see. Gosh, we were on the national news virtually before Bush and Reagan.
Right, that was a top story.
It was a tough story always leading into, you know, usually said, oh, the news started out, you know, Ernst Zündel had another day in court today. So then I was stranded in Canada for 6.5 years, not being able to move even to the United States to visit my brother or my friends, do my business there. I was like in Siberia, you know, I was in the gulag.
Why did they take away your passport?
Well, they said that I was damaging vital interests of the German state. And these vital interests were defined as making good damage done to Jews by Germany. And I was damaging that by questioning the basis for that, you see.
When you say they...
The German interior minister at the time gave a press conference in which he lambasted me for my publishing efforts. Immediately, I asked my attorney, Rieger, to go and contest this seizure or non-issuing of my passport. And so for 6 years... We fought with the German government all the way to the highest courts. And finally, miraculously, I also won that case. After 6.5 years, they had to give me a German passport. And the highest administrative court in Germany said, surprisingly enough, in retrospect, that you could not yank a German's passport and ground him just for unpopular political opinion or unpopular opinions on history. And so the German government was ordered to issue me a passport.
And they did.
And they did for 1 year only. And so I immediately took them back to court because a normal German passport is issued for 10 years.
Right.
And so we fought again up and down the hierarchy in the courts. And after about 3/4 of a year, they had to give me a 10-year passport. With that passport, I could travel the world again.
The whole thing took about 7 years. When did that end?
It ended in 1992. The interesting thing about that passport was that they again refused to give me a new passport in 2002. I was in the United States. By then I had married my wife Ingrid, and I lived first in California, then in Tennessee, and my passport had expired. But by then I had already applied for landed immigrant status in the United States and so on. So it really didn't affect me. But
right.
Because they kidnapped me and expelled me when I was taken across the Canadian borders, the Canadian border police said, you have an expired passport, and therefore they arrested me. And I never was free thereafter until 7 years later.
Wow.
So passports are very, very important control mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. That was in the early 90s. You went through something called a Holocaust trial. Is that right?
Yeah, not one, a whole series. Started in December 1983, and it ended in effect August the 27th, 1992. After 9.5 years of litigation, the Canadian Supreme Court found that the law under which they tried me, that false news law that I told you about from 1275,
right,
that I was in fact correct in saying it was unconstitutional. They declared that law unconstitutional. They removed it from the Canadian Criminal Code.
So again, you were vindicated.
I was vindicated. In the meantime, I had gone 12 times to Canadian jails, had my name smeared all over, had been bombed, vilified. It was an awful time. They claimed that I knew that generally accepted notion was that so and so many people died in German concentration camps. And the booklet that I was charged because of, which I was charged, Did Six Men Really Die?, questioned that.
And that book is for sale right now on Amazon.com.
The book is for sale all over the world, and it is even for sale in Canada. It was never banned. Even during my trial, it was not banned.
So where's the rationale in all this?
The rationale really was that I offended one powerful, well-connected political lobby.
Because you were promoting this book.
Because I was questioning.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the book title had a question mark at the end.
Right.
And I always was of the opinion that you could, for my university days, this was the beauty about North America. You know, Canada and America, we were not as dogmatic as European nations and states, you know, where they had state-ordered a kind of orthodoxies. America and Canada, they're different. That's why I love this continent, you know?
Right. So this book, you didn't find any historical inaccuracies in it, and you still haven't.
The prosecution pointed out about 5% where what they said was matters of interpretation. In other words, they didn't like the interpretation this young man, the author from England, had put on something. And then there were some factual errors, like about a Red Cross report. There were a whole series of Red Cross reports, and I had bought these Red Cross reports, but I did also not see or realize that the one Red Cross report was 164 pages and the other one was 500 pages. So there was a mix-up. But even the prosecution admitted that 95% of the booklet were correct.
Okay. So there were minor errors.
Minor errors in it, yeah.
Right.
And which, by the way, I undertook voluntarily to A, remove the old version and produce a new version with the errors corrected and apologized.
Because that wasn't enough.
No.
Yeah. You said something about a bomb?
My house was bombed for the first time September the 4th, 1984.
What kind of a bomb was it?
It was a pipe bomb that exploded. The damage to my Jewish neighbor's house and to my own garage and to my car. And as a consequence, I lost all my insurance policies. which was dramatic and traumatic, because I had had millions of miles driven accident-free, and suddenly in Canada, you have to have a car insurance. And so luckily, they had what they call a bad driver's insurance. And so instead of paying $550 a year for my car insurance, I now pay $3,750. In my camera insurance for my cameras, because by then I was into broadcasting and making TV programs and so on. Suddenly, I couldn't insure my cameras, and so I went to Lloyd's of London. Most of your listeners might still know that it was a very big international insurance company.
Sure.
And now I had to pay $14,000 for my insurance that I used to pay $1,700 normally, you know? I got, they called it a war zone insurance for my building. Perfectly peaceful downtown Toronto. I had a wartime insurance.
I'm laughing, but I'm not.
No.
You
right.
know what I mean. And did they catch the person?
Never. There was a Jewish organization claimed credit for it, but they never found people.
Actually. Did they investigate?
The Toronto police, very good, always. I must say that, you know, over the years, the Toronto police were a standout in their impartiality, and I had extremely good police protection from these people. I mean, after all, I was a bit of a squeaky wheel in the wagon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the Toronto cops were tops.
And you said this was the first bomb?
First bomb, yeah. The next one came on the 8th of May, 1995. That was to celebrate the German defeat, 50th anniversary. The bomb came 1 week after they had burned the top floors of my house down and inflicted $450,000 worth of damage to my equipment and so on. You know?
This was a Jewish group?
They took credit for it, and the Toronto Sun investigated it and traced it to a group in New York. Yeah. Eventually, actually, four people were charged.
Really?
For sending the bomb.
Okay. What happened?
But then the problem was that the lawyers, the defense lawyers for those people wanted, as you can in American courts and in Canadian courts, the process of discovery, you know. They wanted to find out if the cops had done everything, their investigation legitimately, everything was on the up and up.
Right.
And so the Canadian Spy Service and the Canadian Intelligence Service, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, at the advice or maybe advising the government, decided not to continue the prosecution, to keep it in suspension. So no trial took place. I was supposed to testify because the search warrants through which they found the bomb-making equipment and so on said for the attempted murder of Ernst Sundel. And so I was supposed to be the first witness up.
Did the bomb go off?
No. That might sound a bit strange to your listeners. The postman came in the morning to my house, and the building had been, of course, burned out. And so we had no lights, and we had no windows and no doors, and the carpet was soggy because the firefighters, of course, had poured in thousands of gallons of water into this old building. So the postman comes in, and I usually receive 60, 70 letters a day, an armful of mail.
Wow.
And there was one box that looked like a shoebox, very tightly wrapped with transparent tape, and it was heavy, so heavy that it nearly fell on my table, you know. And I looked at the postman, who was an Irishman, and I said, "Hey, Irish, what are you bringing me? Old bars?" As a joke, you know.
Right.
And he said, "Boy, I was wondering myself, this is one heavy parcel, you know." And so as I was receiving the mail from him across my desk, a voice, I kid you not, a voice said into my ear, as loud and clear as you and I can now telephone, "Ernst, do not open that parcel. There is something wrong with the parcel." In a Canadian accent, loud and clear.
Wow.
Oh, and I thought to myself, I think I'm going nuts.
Right.
And so what happened was, I was going to give it to my secretary, who was waiting to receive the mail. We had this routine, you know, and she would then go through the mail and see what was in it, you know.
Right.
And so as I was handing her the mail, this voice gave me a real blast with a command, very loudly saying, "Do not open that parcel. There is something wrong with the parcel." And that shocked me, you know, twice.
Was it a man's voice or a woman's voice?
Man's voice. Middle-aged Canadian accent.
Right.
And so I hesitated, kept that heavy parcel back, gave my secretary, and she said, "Well, how about the parcel?" I said, "There's something wrong with that parcel," echoing what the voice had said. I had security monitors with security cameras all around
right.
my building, and I put it between my monitors and left it there. Never thought of it again because, of course, we had workmen pumping water out of the basement and so on, you know?
Right.
And so one of my workers, a lady, came by and she picked up the parcel and shook it and it rattled. And she had children, and I said, will you leave that parcel alone? There is something wrong with it. Put it back down. And so for 4 or 5 days, it was resting there between these monitors while we were setting about repairing my building. And then one morning, I'm taking a shower, and my security detail, one of my men who was doing security duty, received a phone call while I was having a shower in the building. And there was an address on that suspicious parcel. And he said to this young man, do you know this address? Came from Vancouver. Do you know his address? He says, oh, hell, that was my address, sister young man. I had met that young man on a speaking tour 2 weeks before that, and right. So I knew that there was something wrong with the addressee. Whoever was using this man's address, because he had given it back, was a P.O. box, given it back to the Canadian Postal Authorities 2 years before. Then I knew somebody was sending a parcel under a fake address.
So what did you do then?
So then I went into my garage, opened the trunk of my car, put a sack of bird feed in to make it nice and soft, and I took that parcel and drove it to the police station.
Okay.
It was about 500, 600 yards away.
Right.
And by then I knew, boy, this was dangerous freight I was carrying, you know. Took it into the police station parking lot, opened the trunk, took it out, but it was on a holiday weekend, put it on the floor, drove my car away 400 meters, put it on the side of the parking meter, went inside to the cop shop, and I said, gentlemen, I think I have a bomb out there. And they knew me because they had to do guard duty, because there were always demonstrations outside my building headquarters, you know. And so they immediately took me in for questioning, and for the next 3.5 hours, I was questioned by 4 different police agencies in Canada who let me go at the end of the afternoon once they had x-rayed the parcel with one of these remote control tanks in an x-ray machine.
Right.
And they took it in a kind of a very strong, like a mini tank, drove it outside Toronto to an island and blew it up. Because they couldn't get into it, but they had found there were over 100 construction nails in it and almost a kilogram of high explosive.
So if that went off...
That night, I was watching the evening news, 10 o'clock news, and the first item on, of course, came, well, Ernst Jindal received a powerful bomb today. Luckily, he didn't open it. The police bomb squad tried to open it, couldn't do it, and so they detonated it at this safe place, and bang, you could see the bomb go off that was supposed to kill me.
Oh. It was quite powerful.
It was the most powerful bomb, the chief of the bomb squad said, that they were ever confronted by, and they couldn't dismantle it. It would have leveled, he said, the buildings in 90 meters, which is about 300 feet around.
They knew who did it.
After 2.5 years of diligent police work, bugging thousands of phones, they found the perpetrators.
But they dropped the case.
Well, they suspended it. Yeah, because they did not want to reveal the international cooperation that the Canadian police and intelligence agencies had had from allies, you know.
Can you elaborate a little bit about that?
The police explained this to me this way. Look, we have investigated the most thorough, far-ranging police investigation. We have the whole network that we broke open because we bugged all these telephones. They had what they call a telephone tree. In other words, if one of these people called somebody, then everybody who called that somebody was also investigated. And what they had was a royal warrant in Canada. And that meant in each province, there was only one judge allowed to issue a royal warrant. The importance of the royal warrant is that the person that is being surveilled, whose telephone is being listened to, is not told. Normally, under Canadian normal procedure, normal law, the police have to tell you within 3 months that your telephone was being bugged, you know? But with a royal warrant, they don't ever have to tell you.
Right.
And so, they use these royal warrants, apparently in each Canadian province, for over 2.5 years in their investigation. And that's how they found the wires, the batteries. They found the letters written in invisible ink that these people used to send to people and so on, you know.
So because they didn't want to reveal how they went about, how they found it. And that's typical in these type of cases, isn't it?
Well, sure. They told me, look, Ernst, we took care of you. You were not harmed in those 2.5 years. What the hell are you squawking, you know? I kept saying to them, listen, they can go down to Radio Shack and do the same stuff all over again, you know?
You brought the bomb to them.
Yeah, well, sure. They thought I was bombing them. I mean, the cops were my friends.
Right. And they kept you there for about 4 hours.
Yeah. Investigating.
That was nice of them. This was a Jewish group. You spoke before about in front of your place you had regular, I guess, protests. Who was protesting?
The Jewish Defense League, and they said they were going to drive me out. The idea was to drive me out from Canada into the arms of the German judiciary and police.
How often did they protest?
sometimes every 4 weeks. Sometimes they're there 200 people. One time they're there 5,000 people.
5,000?
Yeah.
Wow.
They tie up the traffic downtown. I lived on a main thoroughfare, and they tie up the traffic for 2 hours.
Have you ever protested against Jewish groups at all?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Publishers and movie houses and textbook publishers and so on.
What form did your protest take?
Absolutely always peaceful. I was known as the Gandhi of the right.
Mm-hmm.
And I never allowed, for instance, people that would come and drink. Nobody was allowed to mouth off at the public. I always cleared it with the police department. Even in Canada, it's like in the United States, you don't have to have permits. But I always felt these cops had a difficult enough job to do. I would go there to see them at the police station. I said, look, this weekend we are protesting at this and this and this for this and this issue. And here is the press release that we have put out. If you have any questions, you can call me day or night. And my people have been instructed by my lawyers what to say, what not to say, not to block any entrances to businesses or so on, you know?
Right.
In all the 42 years that I was in Canada, did I ever offend against the laws outside of a speeding ticket? I never was criminally charged with anything else except for these thought cases.
Thought crimes.
Yeah.
Are you anti-Semitic?
Certainly not. During my court cases, I had Jewish scholars that would come and testify for me.
You don't have anything against the Jewish people?
No, I do not.
And that's in the public record in your court cases.
That's right. Some I like, some I don't like, just like I do with French Canadians or Irish people. You know?
Just like anybody else.
So is this.
But the only thing that seems to have gotten these groups excited was that you were questioning the conventional wisdom.
The conventional wisdom and the numbers and the methods.
Right. So you were kind of a forensic scientist, isn't that right?
I did what I thought the German government should have done decades earlier. Ordinarily, if a claim is made against a person or against a company, then forensics kicks in. Every Canadian, every American, every German knows these TV programs where they go and investigate.
Right, sure.
You do a forensic investigation and you weigh it and you don't have political preferences, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You strictly go after the scientific facts and so on.
Right.
But since nobody had done that, to my knowledge, I decided once I was charged. You know, this is an important point to make.
Okay.
I would not have wasted my life or my time to make a forensic investigation of anything. I always thought that's why we paid cops and intelligence agencies.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a job of a private person to do that, you know.
Right.
And so I would not have concentrated my mind. But once my freedom was at stake and my rights, I take that very, very seriously, you know.
Right. So once you found out that really they weren't going to let you exercise your freedom.
Yeah, that's right. I fought my case along the freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of thought platform. I always was a champion of the American Bill of Rights. We didn't have it in Canada as sweeping as you lucky Americans had it. Much of it now is being whittled down.
Were any of these charges, Ernst, called Holocaust denial charges?
Not really, because in Canadian law, that's not against the law to question. That's why they never forbade the booklet.
Right. So were you ever charged with something called Holocaust denial?
Only in Germany. The laws over the years have been very much strengthened, very strict, very dangerous territory.
Mm-hmm. So you're in Germany right now,
that's
and
right.
In Germany there are Holocaust denial laws.
That's right.
Okay. Can you explain to our listeners what are Holocaust denial laws?
The idea is that the state has decreed that this crime took place, you see?
The way that it took place.
And the way that it took place. And if you question the idea or even some of the details, then you are offending against this statute. And in my case, it meant that things that I had thought, written, and said in the United States and in Canada, where it was perfectly legal and where I was freed by the highest court, now suddenly I found myself for 5 years in prison.
Do you know of any other topic or historical event that has laws such as Holocaust denial laws?
In the Western world, not really anymore, but in Muslim countries, as you saw from the controversy about the caricatures published in Denmark.
Muhammad, right?
Yeah, Muhammad, you know, you cannot vilify the prophet and so on.
Right.
But in the Western world, generally speaking, we have had for many, many years, well, you know, during the Middle Ages and the Inquisition, it was different, but I thought that we had left that behind us, you know?
So Holocaust denial is pretty much a law that protects the conventional way of viewing the Holocaust, and there aren't any other historical topics out there that have denial laws associated with them.
Some pressure groups are working on some issues, but everybody in Europe basically knows that this one big taboo exists, you know? While I was in prison, a French book was published with a title called Taboo, and it is about my case, yeah.
So Holocaust denial means that you can't have an opinion, you can't think of this event in other ways than is...
No, you make an error of judgment. You leap to a conclusion there. Yeah, my judge in Mannheim and his assistant judge, Judge Meinertshagen, made it perfectly clear to me. He said, Mr. Zündel, we understand that you lived in America and that the freedom of speech has a far greater range, has a far higher social component and standing to it. It's far more important. But you are now in Germany, and therefore you can still think what you want to think, but you cannot say what you think. He made that perfectly clear. He said you cannot say in public what you think about this topic.
What were you thinking when he told you that?
What was I thinking?
Right.
I was thinking that America was paradise.
Right.
Canada. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I thought I had been driven out of paradise, you know?
So you went through your Holocaust trials. You were exonerated in both of them eventually, is that right?
Yes, I was. Uh-huh.
Okay. So pretty much every trial that you were involved with, any legal action, you were exonerated.
Yep, except for the one in Mannheim now, where it was upheld up to the Supreme Court, the Germans they would call the Constitutional Court. It was upheld. And I served every second and every minute and every hour of those 5 years. I got the maximum penalty, and I got no help in any way of release or early release. I made applications and so on,
right,
but nothing was granted. So,
okay.
And I'm now working under 3 years of probation still, post my 5 years. That's why I'm trying to be extremely careful with you. And some people think that I'm some kind of a coward because I don't touch this topic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm bound by German law and statutes that I must not discuss this topic. I must not deny it. I can think whatever I want to think, but I must not say publicly what I think.
Right. You can only think it. Speech crimes are a big thing in Germany. In 08, 09, about 10,000 people were arrested for speech crimes. Isn't that true?
It's an ungodly number of people that have been criminalized because they expressed opinions which they held and were not supposed to express publicly.
That's scary.
Yeah. For an American, it's almost unbelievable. And it's very, very difficult for American interviewers to wrap their mind around this concept, you know?
Right.
And, of course, I was raised, in a way, in the United States. I came to maturity. I am a North American by acculturation, you know? I am in my thinking and in my soul far more American than I am German. I have a German passport. I was raised here. I'm not running down my own fatherland, but... By culturally speaking, I believe that America and Canada, up to the point when they railroaded me, up to that point, Canada had a very similar setup. You know, Canadians were always free to believe and to think and to say what they thought, but it's no longer that way now.
You're in Germany, and your wife, Ingrid, she's in the United States.
That's right.
You met your wife in 94, is that right?
I did, uh-huh.
At a conference. And you were married in 2000, is that right?
Right, uh-huh.
Okay. So you've been married now about 10 years.
Right.
Now, besides the historical revisionism and the Holocaust denial, with these laws that allow you to think but not speak what you're thinking, there's also something specific in Germany, isn't there, about glorifying one of the past leaders of Germany?
If you say something positive about the regime in place from 1933 to 1945, then you can go up to 3 years in prison.
The regime that was in place in those years, of course, headed by Adolf Hitler.
Right.
Legally, you are not allowed to say anything positive about this regime.
Well, at your own risk, because so many thousands of Germans of the generation that lived through that, even if they truthfully in their diaries or their memoirs were to say something and have said something positive, they can be hauled before the courts and can be convicted to huge fines. I mean, I was fined once in Munich for 30,600 Deutschmarks.
Which is how much in dollars?
Maybe $15,000.
Why did they fine you?
Same old topic.
You said something positive about the regime.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. and questioned other things.
Right. There probably were some positive aspects of the regime, of the individual, which there are positive aspects about every individual.
I'm not going to tell you.
Right, you can't. Right, exactly. Right.
Right.
You can't tell me, and I don't want you to tell me. But
you are an American. You are free to think what you think and,
right now,
and say what you want to say, you know.
Right, I am right now.
Lucky you.
So from the time that you met your wife and you married in 2000, was that a quiet time in your life? Is that right?
I was in 1996 immediately charged by the Canadian Human Rights Commission.
A few days after you were exonerated.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And Human Rights Commission.
A Human Rights Commission, which you don't have in the United States yet in that same form. And again, in front of that commission, it's like a political tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
The prime minister of the day appoints the judges, and the commission appoints the investigators.
Right.
And the tribunal basically prosecutes for what the commission investigates.
Okay, so it's like the Department of Justice and the FBI. So it's the Historical Rights Commission is the executive body, and the Historical Rights Tribunal is the enforcement arm.
With one difference,
mm-hmm.
It's a quasi-court because they are not judges. They can be anybody. It can be a butcher or a candlestick maker.
So
the prime minister appoints these people, men and women, usually because they had performed services like collecting their money bags for the party, you know.
Okay, I see. So
these are like plum jobs they pass out to these people, you know,
right,
because they get $300, $500 a day, $1,000 a day. I don't know how much it is today.
So if they see somebody who might be threatening their position.
The political wisdom of the day, political correctness, and then they come down on you like a ton of bricks. And in my case, of course, I was an easy target. I was known for my viewpoints, and so once again, the same booklet, the same ideas, and I litigated then for over 5 years, from 96 to 2002.
For what, hate crimes?
Well, yeah, you could say they considered it hate. And you see, the important thing is that in Canada, truth is a defense. This is the beauty about the Canadian political system, and that's why I won my cases, because I say I am able to prove that what I'm saying is historically correct.
Right.
Now, in Germany, it's not like that, you know, and so therefore I'm not able to say it and I won't say it. But in Canada, truth is the ultimate measuring, the gold standard, you know.
Right. Truth is a defense, but where is truth no defense?
In front of the Human Rights Commission.
So what happened with this Human Rights Commission?
Well, there the criterion is, did one hurt the feelings of the reader who read something?
Hmm.
However truthful it might be, you are not allowed to hurt somebody's feelings.
Which is very subjective.
Totally.
Then truth is no defense?
That's right.
Did they say that to you?
Specifically in writing, wrote that it makes no difference what the truth is. It is no defense in these proceedings. And that's when I made the decision that I am going to cross the border and live with my wife in the United States, where truth was a defense.
Right. You went to the United States in what year?
In the year 2000.
And you got married?
Yes, we got married. We had a wonderful time for 2.5 years. For the first time in my life, I felt totally at ease and free.
In your book, Setting the Record Straight, Letters from Cell Number 7,
mm-hmm.
by political prisoner Ernst Zundel, on page 19, you said, Ernst decided his part of the struggle was done. And incidentally, this is from the open letter to the Congressional Judiciary Committee.
Right.
Headed by Congressman James Sensenbrenner.
I think my wife wrote that letter.
That's right.
You see, I'm a little handicapped because I have never seen that book. All these documents and what you are quoting from the book,
yes.
I have never seen the book because, of course, I was incarcerated and my mail was censored and I could not get many of the documents that Ingrid sent to Congress, like Congressman Sensenbrenner,
mm-hmm.
and I certainly have not seen that book.
Well, let me read from it a bit. It says, Ernst's censorship battles had lasted 3 decades. He was known globally for his politically incorrect views, but had no criminal record on this continent where he had spent all his adult life. He was married to a U.S. citizen, that's Ingrid, of course, seeking adjustment of status pursuant to a properly filed application, which had been authorized by the Attorney General. Suddenly, with no provocation, he was brutally arrested and deported. Dictatorships act that way. Democracies have procedural safeguards, including habeas corpus. We're speaking about the event that took place February 5th of 2003, is that right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Tell our audience what happened on that day.
I was 2 weeks away from opening my art gallery. I had bought a building in the United States, fixed it up. A man had gone bankrupt. It was a very nice building, and it was at a very well-traveled way to the Smoky Mountain National Park. 1.5 million cars would drive by there every year. It was an ideal situation to exhibit my paintings, paintings which I had made in the United States, in Canada, over the decades. And I was going to basically retire and start a new life. And then I was framing my pictures for the opening of my gallery, and a whole posse came in to my driveway, and out leapt the constabularies, you know, American officials of different agencies, arrested me without an arrest warrant and put me in handcuffs, didn't allow me to go back in the house, didn't allow me to get my glasses, didn't allow me to hug my wife, kiss her goodbye, nothing. They just yanked me off and put me in these vans and took me off. And that was the end of that. Never saw an American judge, nothing.
This would have been prevented if the concept of habeas corpus had been exercised, is that right?
That's right. A local lawyer came to the aid of Ingrid, and we did make some submissions to a local court, but they yanked me out of there so fast that I never even got a hearing.
What is habeas corpus, Ernst?
Well, it's one of the most wonderful things that Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence has evolved, which is really a big separation barrier between a tyrannical system and a civilized system. That means that you have to be allowed to see a judge. In some countries, it's 72 hours. In other countries, it's 48 hours. In other countries, it's in 24 hours. But this is the hallmark of civilized free societies, where you are brought before a judge who hears your side of the story, hears the prosecutor's side of the story, and then decides whether you are a danger to the public, whether it was correct, remands you, releases you in bond, and so on, you know?
Right. Translated to, what, show me the body or something like
that's
that?
That's right. That's what it is. You know? Yeah. In other words, was there genuine cause for depriving a person of their freedom? Because in Anglo-Saxon societies, especially in the United States, this is a very, very high public good to be not deprived by state intervention of your freedom.
But they did it to you.
Well, they did it to me and to thousands of others, it turned out, you know.
So what does that say about?
It means that the attacks on the United States on September 11 basically changed the political judicial landscape in the United States.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about September 11th. This booklet, Stranger Than Fiction, an independent mm-hmm. investigation of 9/11 and the war on terrorism by Anonymous, back then, right. Of course, now we know ostensibly who wrote it. Of course, it's for sale on the internet also. You wanted to disseminate this pamphlet, to publish this.
I had published in my newsletters within 2 weeks of the attack, I was questioning the official line
right.
within 2 weeks.
Okay.
Because there were so many discrepancies. Actually, in discussions with my lady attorney in Canada, I questioned it within 35 minutes. If you have a background of political history and political science, there were glaring problems, you know?
Right.
And so I kept publishing in my monthly newsletters questions about it, just questions, you know, did they, why they, you know, when did Bastille really melt and so on, you know?
Mm-hmm. We should question, obviously, everything, right?
That's the job of revisionism, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. So what happened with this booklet then?
The booklet came anonymously via the internet, and I glanced through it and thought to myself, well, you don't have to spend weeks and months writing all this stuff down. That's exactly what your thinking is. And so for a point of discussion with some of my subscribers, we produced photocopies of that booklet.
Okay.
And many people think that this is the reason why I was so quickly yanked from the United States.
Because with your forensic skills.
I think that that's what broke my spine, that they knew that I had a history of thoroughness and understood what a forensic investigation was, and they did not want to have that done by me.
You did it about the Holocaust. You brought in expert witnesses from around the globe, and you disputed a lot of the...
Yeah, well, I can't comment on
it. No, I don't want you to. No, I'm just saying
situation, yeah.
I don't want you to comment on it. I didn't state that before, and I wanted our listeners to know that this was something that you did successfully in court, and now powers that be were afraid that you would bring those skills to bear on 9/11. So they came to your home 2 weeks before you were preparing to open up your art gallery.
That's right.
They took you away. They didn't allow you to get your glasses. They didn't allow you to say goodbye to your wife properly.
Yep.
And where did they take you? From Tennessee to where? And no judge, by the way, no habeas corpus, no nothing.
No habeas corpus.
Yeah,
nothing.
Okay. And
they took me to a holding center in what looked like a garage, photographed me, and then they prepared some kind of a document, which really wasn't an arrest warrant, just some kind of a document that the INS, now they have changed it to Homeland
right.
Security. But anyway, so the INS is the one that was in charge of me from that moment on, and they kept me for about 2 weeks in Blount County Jail, which looked like Laurel and Hardy movies. You know, we had these uniforms with white and black stripes.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. That was a surprising experience for me. It was for the first time in an American prison. And the most surprising was that the prisoners were hungry. They always asked for food. We are hungry, we are hungry. And they got small portions, but the food was of inferior quality. And so naturally, it wasn't sustaining to these big American, you know, Big Mac used to guys, you know.
Right.
And so one morning, I heard dogs barking, and I wondered, what the hell are dogs? You know, this is like in a cheap movie.
Right.
And in burst black uniformed, what looked to me like special forces. They were not like our prison guards, which were in brown uniforms with beige piping in Tennessee, but
right.
These were black uniformed people with parachutist boots on, with black helmets, sunglasses. Strangely enough, they had dogs on their leashes. One was a pit bull, the other one was a German shepherd, and they were yapping, and we were all lying on the floor, trussed like turkeys, with our arms and hands behind our back. And I was closest to the dog handler, and that dog was so furious, I could smell his foul breath, and saliva from the dog dripped on my arm. Was a very frightening, scary experience. And then a very pretty young woman with a handy cam, with a very tight flak jacket on top, came in, climbing over the prisoners, in close-up, videotaping these men shaking and crying, grown-up men crying. They were so frightened from these dogs. You know?
What was the purpose of it?
I don't know. Maybe intimidation. But that was long before Abu Ghraib.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, and I wonder, was that a training exercise? Because they had no rank. They had no name tags. You know, you couldn't determine were they prison staff, were they special forces, who were these people. And then we made applications through the courts later on. We never got an answer to this day. I want those films back, you know. This shows me in my most vulnerable, intimidated position, you know.
It's so cruel that they would come in there and do this. If it was a training exercise, which is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
How they don't have any feelings for how they're making people feel, no matter what.
They laughed. The women laughed with the guards together. Oh, they had a good old time, you know. And I thought to myself, I would have never believed that anywhere in the United States this could happen.
And where is Blount County? What state is it?
Blount County is, Knoxville.
Okay, so it is still Tennessee, okay.
Oh, it's Tennessee.
Okay, so, and how far away from your
home? It was 20 minutes away from my home.
And how long were you kept there? 2 weeks, you said?
2 weeks, yeah. Mm-hmm. They shipped me to Canada.
No habeas corpus, no judge, no nothing?
Nothing, nothing.
Right, and was there any communication with anybody?
Yeah, Ingrid came to see me just one time. They were trying to slough her off, but she managed to come and see me the Saturday before they shipped me out.
Now, Ingrid ran a website, is that correct?
That's right. Huh?
Okay. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
It's called jundelsite.org.
Okay.
And she ran it since 1994-95.
When she met you then, she was, I guess, inspired by you?
She took to the internet like a duck to water.
Right.
You know? And so since she was free in the United States, she actually chose the name, registered all in her name. All the documentation is in her name from day one.
Okay, and it's still on the internet, zundelsite.org.
Yeah, it's still on the internet.
Around this time, 94-95, it was quite a popular site, wasn't it?
It was a very well-visited site because it was one of the first.
One of the first revisionist sites.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The authorities, did they really want to have this site shut down? Is that something that was on their radar screen?
Not so much the authorities, you know, the people who were, let's say, the inspiring minds.
Right, using the authorities to do their dirty.
Right.
I got you. And did they offer you some kind of a deal?
Well, once I was shipped to Germany, I could have had a reduced sentence if I had implicated my wife, you know, made her a part of the crime of Holocaust denial, you know.
And what'd you tell them?
I certainly served the full 5 years. That gives you an indication
right.
that no deal took place.
Before we get to Germany. While you were in Blount County, Tennessee, what were the conditions like?
I was very surprised because everybody was thrown together there. They were murderers and kinds of criminal elements, drug pushers, dope pushers, and so on. What I found was the extreme unkindness and coldness by the officials. After all, I was not convicted yet.
Right.
You know, in most countries, people who are in investigative custody, like in Germany, for instance, you are assumed innocent until you are proven guilty. But in my case, apparently, I was guilty from the moment that the handcuffs had closed.
What were some of the things they did?
I was treated just like any of the other murderers and so on, you know. But it was only a brief stint of 2 weeks. But I was shocked because I, of course, being a lover of America, I always thought America was different.
They were above all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I thought this was.
What was your cell like?
A cell, very small bunk bed that I climbed on top. And the windows were painted in some kind of a glass. You couldn't look out.
Mm-hmm.
And your belongings were in a plastic box on the floor, and the food certainly was of poor quality and inadequate, and so was the medical care.
You were taking any medication at that time?
Yeah, I was.
Okay, blood pressure?
Yeah, they were not giving me anything for that at all, and I had come actually to the prison with a treatment that I was on, but they just laughed when they saw that, when they asked that I could continue on that, you know?
So they took away your doctor-prescribed medication?
That's right, no, that's right.
Any repercussions?
My blood pressure shot sky high. When I got to Canada, they were afraid that I might basically die, get a stroke. And so they leaned on me and brought my son in, who was a paramedic, as the fire chief of his community, and he leaned on me that I should take beta blockers that I get my blood pressure down, you know? After all, I was being jerked around. No wonder my blood pressure was up.
Right. Are they allowed to do that? Aren't there rules in place that would protect your...
Yeah, you'd be amazed how quickly you find that rules look very good on paper, but dark, ugly reality is very different.
2 weeks in the Blount County prison, and then they took you to Canada, you said?
Yep, 6 o'clock in the morning, they hauled me out with two what turns out to be U.S. Marshals.
Okay.
And we flew out from Knoxville to Atlanta, from Atlanta to Buffalo. Nobody told me where I was going, and I only found out at the counter, looking at the flight number, you know, that I was headed for Buffalo. Then I realized I wasn't being sent to Germany. And then they brought me in one of the worst snowstorms and blizzards across to the Canadian side, and the Canadians didn't want to take me. And so they shipped me back to a place in New York State called Batavia, New York.
Okay.
And there I met about 740 Muslims who also were being denied habeas corpus and were shipped out plane load after plane load.
Hmm. And this was, of course, in February of 2003.
Yeah, February 2003.
How long were you in Batavia for?
Only 2 days. They were nice. The New York State prison there was certainly far superior to the Tennessee one.
So for 2 days, they kind of treated you almost like a human.
Yeah, they treated me like Americans should treat people.
After those 2 days, where'd you go?
They shipped me back to Canada, and then my ordeal began. From that moment on, I was always in solitary confinement.
How long were you in Canada for?
2 years.
Was this where you were taken to the reception area and put into a wire cage?
That's right. Uh-huh.
Can you tell our listeners about that?
It's like in a cheap Hollywood movie about Alcatraz.
Okay.
To make it short, that's basically what the whole surroundings were. And then I wrote to my wife and I wanted to make a will, you know. And so they thought that this meant I was suicidal, you know.
Right.
So they yanked me out of my already less than comfortable cell, put me in the suicide watch cell, where they strip you of everything that you have, and they put you in Kevlar, of which bulletproof vests are made.
Right.
Kevlar outfit they call a baby doll, which is really like a Kevlar blanket with two straps on.
Okay.
Very humiliating. And they keep you on Kevlar bedding, no pillows, in a place that looks like a morgue.
And this is in the wire cage?
It was in the wire cage.
So they could view you from every angle?
From every angle, yeah.
Okay, I was wondering what that go get the baby doll for Sundel.
Yeah, yeah. That's
now
it.
I know what it is. Okay, and how long were you in that wire cage?
I was only in 1.5 days because by that time I had a lawyer and a lady shrink came to see me. She was French-Canadian. And first question she asked, do you ever get the feeling that you are being persecuted? So I said, my dear young lady, she was half my age, less, you know, I said, don't you know who I am and anything about me? No, she had not the faintest clue who I was, you know.
Right.
So I told her about the bombs and the fire and my court cases. And so she got up and she said, Mr. Tindall, I will check into this file. I'll be back. 20 minutes later, she came. She said, well, I checked the file. You certainly have reason to believe that you are being persecuted, and therefore, within 5 minutes, the guards will come and let you free out of this baby doll situation, you know? Back to my solitary confinement, without a chair, without a table, 24 hours light a day.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. That was something that was very disturbing to me. The cell was 6x9, is that right?
About like that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was a light on in the cell 24/7?
Yep, 24/7, a neon fluorescent light from the ceiling.
You couldn't turn it off?
No switches on the inside of the cell, no plug for Walkman or TV, nothing, absolutely nothing. There was no outlet, no electricity that the prisoner could get at.
And you had no chair?
I had no chair. And luckily, I had amassed so many files after a few months, because I took the Canadian government to court and so on.
Right.
And then I had lots of court files, and I made myself a chair out of my files. And so the captain of the guards, who had served some time in Germany with the Canadian Armed Forces, said, oh, typical German ingenuity. You made yourself a chair.
Funny, not. Yeah. So on page 36 of your book, you say, I'm locked in 24 hours a day, 10 minutes walk in the fresh air, weather permitting, 10 minutes shower and phone time. And the phone time wasn't all the time, of course. That's it. No newspapers, no partials permitted from friends or relatives that might contain books, no ballpoint pens, only pencil stubs. Now, they kept you in this condition for 2 years, is that right?
2 years, yeah.
Okay. It took you over 7 months to get the pillow that you requested, is that right?
That's right, yeah. They were short of pillows, they told me. And I thought to myself, holy smokes, in a dollar store you can get a pillow. I offered to pay for one, you know.
Right. And on page 99, where you say, cooped up in a 6x9-foot solitary confinement jail cell where the lights are on day and night, guards come to write down all my actions every 20 minutes, 24 hours a day, where I get 10 minutes of fresh air by myself, in a concreted over, totally enclosed prison yard where no one speaks to me for days, sometimes weeks, where all visits and phone calls have to be pre-approved.
Yep.
You were treated, I guess, beyond how a murderer many people would think should be treated.
I was frankly shocked. You know, Canada was a land that I grew up in. You know, I matured in Canada. I went to university there. I had my children there. I couldn't believe that the land of my choice would treat me like that. Amazing.
What about the bed? Was it a regular bed? Or?
You know, it was a foam mattress covered in Kevlar.
More Kevlar.
More Kevlar, yeah. And sometimes it wasn't changed. I forget now. I wrote it in the book how many months the bedding wasn't changed.
Yes. At the time you wrote it, it was 3 months and 10 days.
Yeah.
I remember reading that. So.
Yeah. I mean, Canada, you know, can you imagine that? My Canada. Unbelievable. I wasn't in Outer Slavovia. I wasn't in Siberia in the Gulag. I was 20 minutes away from downtown Toronto.
It's a lot of things. It's horrible.
Yeah.
It should never be allowed to be done.
My cells were just like in Guantanamo, and so was my outfit. I was wearing the flight combination in bright orange. No toothbrush, no toothpaste, no soap, no towel in my cell. So I had to knock on the door and ask the guard to bring me a toothbrush. Well, sometimes they did, sometimes they wouldn't. And outside, in plain view, where everybody was walking by, kicking up dust with their street shoes, that was during a time when the SARS epidemic was on. They were all wearing masks and rubber gloves, and my toothbrush, my soap and everything was on an open box sitting outside in the hall. So I said to them, what the hell are you trying to do, kill me?
That was called Thorold.
Thorold, Ontario. Yeah.
Spent the first 3 months in a windowless cells, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I didn't know it was day or night, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then there were times that went by when you really didn't even touch another human for many weeks, even months, is that right?
Ingrid, when I finally was able to make it to the phone, she said, what's wrong with your voice, Ernst, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Ingrid, I haven't spoken to anybody in weeks. They would open this metal little trap door, shove my food in, and close it.
They arrested you claiming that you violated some laws.
In Canada, they arrested me because I had an expired passport.
But in the United States, they arrested you because of some immigration violations?
Yeah.
Okay, which obviously was not true.
Which was a blatant lie, because I was there legally. We had an attorney, high-powered, who had over 40 years' experience with immigration courts. I was married to a United States citizen. The FBI had come to see me, interrogated me, and I said, at the time, my attorney wasn't present. Since you came so far from Knoxville, an hour's drive, I'll return the favor. I come to your headquarters, bring my attorney journey along, and then you can question me at length. And they did for over 3 hours. And at the end of the interrogation, everything was very cordial, the way I always had experienced American officials to be like. Only later on, through Freedom of Information Act, did I find out that this special FBI agent had recommended to close the Trindle file, saying that we go on the assumption that Mr. Trindle will be allowed to stay. He closed the file.
On page 55, you say, in the past, from 1983 to 1992, I was released by over a dozen judges on a $10,000 property bond and $1,000 in cash. Never once during these 11 years did I break any of my bail conditions, yet this time around, I've been refused bail by the Immigration Department on 5 different occasions already.
That's right.
Okay. For 2 years, you were in this horrible prison, lying on a foam mattress on concrete. In a
slab of concrete. Yeah.
Slab of concrete with no chairs. Of course, you had a makeshift chair from all your paperwork.
Yep.
And I guess the worst part of it was the pencils.
Strange. In the United States, if you had a pencil, this was a very serious infraction. Apparently, the graphite in pencils there is used for tattooing, you know? And so that was a serious crime in the United States to be caught with a pencil. And in Canada, if you were caught with a ballpoint pen, it was a serious crime. So in Canada, they gave me pencils, which were a crime in the U.S., but not in Canada. And they took a saw and cut the pencils in half that were only stubs.
You're a very prolific writer, of course. So for these 2 years that you were in prison, you wrote quite a few letters, because many of them are in your book, Setting the Record Straight, letters from cell number 7. But when the pencils ran down, of course, as pencils do, they didn't allow you to have a pencil sharpener, is that right?
No, they didn't allow me to have a pencil sharpener. Can you imagine that, you know? So there were these big 200-pound beefy guards coming by, and I, you know, sticking my hand through the bars, asking them, begging them like a little boy, Mommy, can you sharpen my pencils, you know?
Right.
So one of these big beefy guys says, today I don't do pencils.
Right. So there are many times that they didn't sharpen your pencils.
That's right, yeah. Mm. But many other guards, and some of them especially like Canadian Indians.
Right.
They were quite nice. And the Indian Indians, like Indian Sikhs,
right,
they were very nice. And another lady, she was a Palestinian, she was nice.
Hmm. I wonder what makes people become like that.
I often wondered about that too. But, you know, I would say in their defense, not every prisoner is Ernst Sindel, you know. There are some prisoners that are in there for very serious crimes, you know.
Right. What about the temperature in the cell?
Cold. Cold. I never felt so cold in my whole life. Awful. And you know, we had no shoes in the prison, so we had only socks. So finally the guards allowed me to wrap T-shirts around my feet. I looked like one of those Stalingrad survivors, you know.
Right. I was thinking about in the U.S. Revolutionary War, the pictures of those soldiers with Washington drudging through the snow.
Yeah, right, in Valley Forge.
Right, exactly. Or the Battle of Trenton. Cold. There was no heating.
As it turns out, I did some investigating later. Obviously, the contractors in the 60s were crooked, and they didn't insulate the building well enough, you know? Basically, it was a slipshod operation.
Was it above ground or below ground?
No, it was slightly above ground.
Okay, but it was all concrete.
It was all concrete.
Right, and after the three-month period, you actually got a cell with a window.
Yep, I did.
Right. Was that cell also 6x9?
All standard sizes. Yeah.
Okay, so it was the same cell, it just had a window.
Yep.
Which, of course, was a big thing, obviously.
It was an improvement, and it had a little triangular metal shelf in the corner, which I could use as a table.
Mm-hmm. But before, no chair.
No, no. Well, I used my files.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, before that, where did you...
I wrote on my bed, sitting there like Gandhi, you know, my legs crossed.
Besides your high blood pressure, did you have any other medical ailments?
I've never smoked in all my life, never drank,
right,
and never took drugs. So that paid off.
Your back didn't act up?
No, nothing.
Where'd they take you next?
I would go back and forth to court because I fought hard for my freedom. Numerous times trying to get released on bail because I'd always been on bail, but this time they were utterly merciless, you know? And so finally I lost before the highest courts. And my deportation order was signed by the highest level of the government, and it was this kind of anti-terrorist security certificate that they issued against me, which was since declared unlawful and unconstitutional by the Canadian Supreme Court.
Since declared, though?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they used it to then...
I'm the only one that was run out of Canada under that certificate. All these Arabs that they falsely accused, it turns out, they were not shipped out. I was shipped out.
You were the only one. And so they shipped you out to Germany.
That's right, yeah. In a privately leased jet with a 7-man crew and guards. And later on, it turns out it cost the Canadian taxpayers, I think, $255,000 or $245,000. Youth Cancer would have taken me for $1,000.
Yeah, right. Why do you think they...
The Minister of Justice was one of them, you know? And so he wanted to report that he railroaded me out, he got me out, he was the one to get me out, lickety split, you know?
Right. But he was probably taking his orders from forces,
yeah.
Behind the scenes, powerful forces were telling him what to do. I mean, that's what they do with the politicians. They get them in there and then they have them do their dirty work, right?
Well, we'll find out. The investigation is still going on because, of course, I'm not going to take that lying down.
Why do you think they sent you to Germany?
The day I was arrested in the United States, the Germans, in conjunction with the FBI, the German police official of the German version of the FBI, called Bundeskriminalamt, his office was in the FBI headquarters. And he received from the German authorities an arrest warrant for me. And since I was railroaded out of the United States, before they could exercise it, it was transferred to Canada. And so the Canadians got it.
So what were they arresting you on?
Basically, the Germans are of the opinion that any German citizen that questions those taboos anywhere in the world is subject to German law and therefore can be extradited to Germany for trial.
Do the citizens of Germany have an opinion on this particular law?
I'm afraid that the citizens of Germany are not really asked very much about their opinions, you know?
So, because you're a German citizen, you can be snatched from anywhere around the world.
As long as local courts submit to the German arrest warrant, yeah.
So, justice, with quotes around it, can be served.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they brought you to Germany. You went on trial.
Yeah, I spent 2.5 years in investigative custody. The trial was postponed, and then it collapsed, and then it was reordered. But all this time, I tried to get out on bail. Nothing. No way. And I spent the entire 5 years in prison, cooped up.
What were those facilities like?
The German prison was an old prison, massively built, actually based on an American design from Pennsylvania, 1864. Many of the German prisons were designed along these American prisons that are like spokes on a wheel. You've seen those, you know, in films and so
right.
on, you know. Built of bricks. It would be familiar to Americans. I'll have to say this. Once I was inside the prison system, the German guards were mostly kind.
Mm-hmm.
And respectful, and the food was certainly far superior to what it had been in Canada and the United States. Medical care was better, and there were social activities, and I certainly had a nice big table. I had a light that I could turn off myself. I could open my window. I had real sheets that were changed every week, pillows from day one, and one could make coffee and tea for oneself, which I couldn't in the 2 previous years. So the Germans have this lousy reputation about being tough and so on. Well, they were the most humane, meaning the uniformed staff. I'm not talking about the political people, you know.
Well, the reputation of the Germans that we're told about via the media is that they're nasty characters.
Yeah, that's right. I found it odd that the nasties that I encountered were in my country of choice, Canada and the United States, you know.
Was it a 6x9 cell?
It was a little bigger than the Canadian ones.
Windows?
Windows that I could open. From the day that I was checked in there to the day that I left, I never closed my windows except one night when there was a snowstorm.
Right.
Outside of that, I'm a fresh air fanatic.
Sure. And tables and chairs?
Nice big table, nice chair. They had a prison store where you could buy every 2 weeks, like vitamin-rich things like lettuce and oranges and so on. You know?
And no more pencils?
No, I could get ballpoint pens. I buy them in the prison store. And the judge, strangely enough, allowed me profi, meaning professional, sable hair brushes and gorgeous watercolors and watercolor paper.
Mm-hmm. So you served 5 years in prison?
Yep. Well, actually right. 7 with the 2 years in Canada.
Right. So you've been married, as I said prior, for 10 years, but for 7 of those years, you haven't been with your wife.
No, I could not see Ingrid because Ingrid, too, has an arrest warrant out for her.
And that was for the website?
For the website, yes.
So for running the website...
Which is legal in the United States, specially protected by various rulings of federal courts and the Supreme Court of the United States.
Hmm. So for running Zundelsite.org, your wife Ingrid has an arrest warrant in Germany.
That's right.
So she can't come to see you?
No, she cannot. Actually, she cannot come anywhere within the European Union, which is 27 countries.
So they are holding you hostage.
I cannot find any other term to express it better.
Thought crime.
Yep.
Websites. You have no violent streaks. You've never broke the law other than a speeding ticket.
Yeah.
You don't believe in war. You don't believe in killing.
I do not believe in violence. I believe violence is the last resort of exhausted minds. My mind has never been exhausted. I do not preach violence.
And, of course, they had to grab you in the United States before you became a citizen, because then it would be much more difficult.
Right? That's right. Even after all those 7 years, I believe that I will be vindicated and that those who did that to me and to others will be found out and they will face the music. I really believe that. I don't know how long it will take, but I believe that justice will be done to those people.
I hope so. On page 102 of your book, in a letter to your wife, you said, "My being jerked around is like all the other Zundel persecutions, to serve people as an example, not to open their mouths or else." Did they accomplish?
Partly they did achieve that, you know, because I must say, to the shame of the revisionist community, there was very little of a campaign. You know, when Angela Davis was footloose and fancy-free for her friends that she had bought machine guns for and so on, and Angela Davis kind of proselytized for these men in the United States, 72,000 Germans came to see her near the airport in Frankfurt.
Wow.
And in Paris, it was 70,000. Now, these were people that were terrorists. Nelson Mandela, he was a convicted terrorist, and tens of thousands of people would show up, you know,
right,
to champion his case. But the people of the patriotic movement or the revisionist community was unable to mount anything of the sort. Actually, American Free Press, the Barnes Review, was really the most active, apart from French revisionists, that came to my aid and did the best that they could.
What does all this say for the First Amendment, for the state of affairs in the United States?
This is one of the ways one can see that the public discourse and America's belief in itself and in its own ideals has greatly been eroded.
What does the future hold for you, Ernst? You're barred from coming to the United States. Your wife is barred from going to Germany for running a website so people could read. What do you think?
I really don't know. That's a good question. And my poor wife, you know, she thinks that I'm too contemplative, you know, that I'm too laid back. Well, what battalions has Ernst?
Right.
I have my mind, I have my ideas, I have my mouth, I have my brain. I have only moral suasion, you know?
Right.
And in an age of immorality, morality itself is like a blunt sword. I don't know. I cannot answer your question. I would love to think that there is some congressman, some committee of the judiciary, somebody at Homeland Security, somebody at the White House that will look at that and say, my God, what the hell did we do to this man and to his wife and to this family, you know?
And to the First Amendment.
And, of course, to our own institutions, you know?
Right.
Sacred documents that we hold dear.
How's your wife holding up, Tennessee?
She is one brave woman. She's the real hero of this piece, in my opinion, you know. All I did is I did the best I could by being in prison, but she is something else. I hold her in very, very high esteem. Respect her and, of course, love her.
What can our listeners do to assist you? Is there anything that we can do?
They could contact Ingrid and be kind to her, write to her. Maybe send some emails. And of course, if people are up to it, contact public officials and shine the light on what the hell happened, not only to me, but since the 11th of September, you know?
Right.
America needs to find back to its roots, to its core values, you know?
Right.
America is a great place. It has all the potential. And Obama saying, yes, we can. I subscribe to that. Yes, we can change things in the United States. If there's one country on the face of the earth that I think can change things, is if the Americans find the collective will that they used to have and that they marshaled. America can and will be, once again, a light amongst nations.
Let's hope you're right, Ernst. The website, again, it's Zundelsite, that's ZUNDELSITE.org. And on that site, you can contact Ernst's wife, Ingrid, and send her an email.
Right. And of course, I need to ask for understanding of your listeners that I am not free to say all the things that I really rightfully should be able to say, but I can't. I am limited by my current situation, and I just hope that people appreciate that.
I want to thank you so much, Ernst Sundel.
Yeah, and I want to thank you and the staff at American Free Press, and of course, old Willis Cardo and his wife Elizabeth. It was very nice for me, in the confines of my cell, to know that there was at least one group out there that cared and that did write about the case. When many others fell silent, they did not.
No, they're not afraid to say what's right.
Mm-hmm.
Ernst Sundel, thanks so much for the time that you took out today to tell your whole story. And I'm sure that mostly all the listeners who will hear this interview are with me and hoping that everything does turn out the way that it should.
It will. My lady attorney in Toronto used to say, onward, upward, forward.
Thank you, Ernst.
Righto, bye-bye.